Ever wonder if there's more to the movies you love? Do you like to ponder how they got from A to Z? Who chose the plot twists? Why use those characters? Is there a deeper meaning? We're here to explore those questions and maybe learn a bit along the way. VGB Studios proudly presents The Filmlosophers.
Hello and welcome to another exciting episode of The Filmlosophers, the show that gets in the movies you love and digs a little deeper. I am your host, Eddie Van Weven. Alongside me, as always, is Mr. Chad Activist Riley.
What's up, Captain?
How's it going, man?
Great. How are you?
Doing well, doing well. And of course, with us at this table is
The distinguished.
The distinguished, the loud, the impressive Spencer Williams.
Why is See how nice I tried to be? And loud. Like, all wrapped up in the same thing.
You take that as a bad thing.
I tried to head him off at the pass. I tried to, like, just cut off whatever nonsense was going to happen. It didn't work.
You know what? There is no nonsense in saying compliments. So, I'm just saying. That's all I'm saying. We have an exciting show for you today as we dig deep into the director-writer aficionado known as Ryan Coogler. So, stick around. But before we start the big show, Chad's going to hit us with a little bit of information.
That's right. The Eagles won the Super Bowl, and one half of our double feature profile today is all about Creed, the most recent film in the Rocky series that also calls the city of brotherly love home. As always, the Filmlosophers podcast is presented by Mingle Media TV and recorded live at VGB Studios. To make sure you don't miss a minute of the banter, don't forget to subscribe to the show on Stitcher, Player FM, Google Play, Audio Boom, Libsyn, or iTunes. New episodes drop each Wednesday morning. And if I find myself, Spencer, in between Wednesdays, and I just can't get enough, what am I to do?
Well, any other day of the week, you can keep the conversation going with us on social media. Like the show on Facebook at facebook.com/filmlosophers. And follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/filmlosophy101. For more movie news and supplemental content. You can also access our entire episode archive at filmlosophers.com.
We got a website.
It's a website that's not really ours, but it links to somewhere where you can get stuff from us.
Technically it is ours. We are paying for it. Well, so we're paying for the domain. So it is what it is.
It's our content. It's our lovely, distinguished voices.
Spencer's trying to make it sound like we've stole this domain and we have no right to it.
I don't know what happened before.
You
I
know
got here.
What?
the man has a point.
Hey, you were the one who said you bought the domain legitimately, so I'm trusting you on that.
I plead the fifth.
Well, speaking of pleading, we have a case to plead as we talk about a very unique writer, very young director, actually, a filmmaker.
He does both. You're right.
Yeah, exactly.
You're not wrong.
Who has been making a name for himself with his recent films, and we decided to jump into his filmography and take a look at what this man has to offer. Indeed,
and it's no coincidence because there's a rather large, prominent, big-budget film that's about to drop that he also directed. So. Yep. There's a method to the madness.
True. As the year gains momentum in terms of cinema, movie fans have been at the edge of their seat in anticipation. Not only does this year boast some pretty incredible films, but it also holds the culmination of what has become an empire above all franchises. That's right. We are talking about Marvel. And this year is bringing to the table some of the most standout films coming out of the comic book studio. Of course, you have Avengers Infinity War, which we are all excited for.
Can't wait for May.
I mean, which, honestly, the film has been the end result of a 10-year marathon, but there's also another film that has gained similar attention and anticipation, and that is Black Panther. Black Panther already being hailed as one of the best superhero films by critics who have had a chance to see a press screening, holds a distinct place in the lineup Marvel has in store. Not only is this film about a superhero, but in the midst of a racially charged world we are currently living in, the representation and portrayal of this long-standing black Marvel superhero needs to be on point. So the powers that be brought in none other than the filmmaker, writer that we've been talking about, Ryan Coogler. So as I said, we are taking a close look at his two films that he's done, and we're going to break down some of the key aspects of the his films and what he brought to the table with those particular projects.
Yeah, I mean, he's risen to prominence pretty quickly in terms of, you know, from kind of having his first major feature film in 2013 to now at the very start of 2018 having a multi-million dollar franchise starter, mega franchise continuer film with Black Panther. I mean, that is quite the trajectory for a career for a young filmmaker in Hollywood these days.
Yeah, it's true, because like you said, Fruitvale Station was just a few years ago. In all honesty, it was less than a decade ago.
It was less than 5 years. I mean, if you go release date to release date, it's less than 5 years.
And you have somebody who happens to have that directorial debut just that recently, and then given the incredible opportunity and honor and responsibility of bringing, like I said, one of the most prolific Black Marvel characters in the history of Marvel, period.
One of the most prolific Black superhero characters, period.
Yeah, ever since his
Marvel,
first appearance,
DC, or otherwise. I mean, he's been around longer than most, and maintained a lot of prominence in print in the comic book part of things.
Yeah. I believe I was reading Black Panther made its debut in comics in around 1966. So if you take that into account, he is almost, if not about as old as the Marvel First Family.
Yeah, I mean, he's just a few years after the Avengers. The Fantastic Four, the Avengers, and the X-Men were kind of the first wave.
Yeah.
Spider-Man, obviously. But Black Panther, I mean, it was a handful of years. It wasn't even a decade later.
Spencer, what do you think are some of the things that, because I don't know if you've been reading a lot about what people are saying for Black Panther, but because you've actually talked about it with us in terms of your anticipation for this film, what are some of the things that you're hoping, aside from what we've seen with Ryan Coogler, what are some of the things that you're hoping Black Panther gets right?
Well, first off, I'm super excited about this. Like, I'm so excited I kind of went like radio silence on everything related to Black Panther on the web.
Smart.
I don't want to know anything more than what I do. I just want to go in and be excited for what happens on that screen. So I am super excited, and I completely forgot what your question was.
No, I'm just wondering. Like,
that's how excited he is,
right? That's hey,
he ain't
you know
even
what?
Listen to you.
You can have your moment. That's all fine and dandy. No, but my thing is this: is that like because you've been pretty outspoken in terms of your anticipation for this film, and you're a fan of the character outside of the big screen. So what are some of the things that you're hoping to see with this particular film?
Well, I just really want to see more of him, because after his entrance in like Civil War, he was so phenomenal. Both him and Spider-Man were phenomenal in that movie. And like, I just really want to get to know more of him in the world, because like in the first trailer for this movie, like just everything in that trailer looked just amazing. Like you had all these people just around in like this African garb that looks like just amazing, and then soundtrack sounds pretty great. Mm-hmm. So everything kind of is gelling together to be like something amazing. Plus, like even the minor stuff I've heard from like people, it's like this is the new king of Marvel to beat. So,
And I mean, I don't want to like obviously stating in this group you are African American, and does this particular character, in terms of what it represents on screen, does that speak anything to you in that aspect?
It speaks like tons, because like the only like Black superhero movie that we've really had are Blade and Steel. And one of those is not that great. I'll let you be the judge on
Wesley
which one.
Wesley Snipes, you're getting the boot. that's right, though. I did forget about Steel.
Well, for great reasons, though.
Hey, you know, Shaquille O'Neal can pull off a really good faux Iron Man. So,
so anyway, yeah, I'm really excited to just have like another like Black character to just meet on the screen and like have everyone just be amazed by what he's gonna do. Like, because I'm really interested in just seeing like more like people of color.
Yeah,
like up on Marvel's roster.
And I mean, let's be honest, Black Panther is one of the coolest characters that exists, period, regardless of background. I mean, this dude, he's a king, he's a superhero, he's amazingly brilliant, one of the smartest people in the world, super technologically savvy. He like enters the spirit realm from time to time in the Wakandan necropolis to commune with the spirits of his ancestors and get their guidance and or have them challenge him. Like he basically is a crossroads for a lot of other character types in the Marvel comic book universe, and presumably they're going to carry at least some of that over into the MCU. I'm super excited for this movie. I think if they're smart, Black Panther becomes the front runner, like the primary character of phase 18 or whatever we're in now, following Avengers 4. I think that they should put him front and center, no questions asked, and I think that this movie is what's going to prove it to people.
As Chad's our local comic historian
nerd,
I gave you a proper title. You went ahead and gave you that, so
that's fine.
Okay,
see, you got as historian. I got loud.
Funny how that works out.
Yeah, it is.
It's okay. I threw myself under the bus.
Anyway, no, as you being the our resident comic historian slash nerd, what are some of the key things? In terms of the Black Panther, what are some of the key things that make him unique? If you've been living under a rock, you haven't seen the previews to it, or you're unfamiliar with the comic book counterpart, what are some of the unique aspects of Black Panther in the comics that you're hoping to see translated on screen?
First of all, he's not American. He is the king of an African nation. Now, granted, it's a make-believe African nation. It's it's made up for the Marvel Universe, and they've carried it into the MCU. But so what the benefit to that, because most of the popular characters, they're all based in or around New York City, because that's where Marvel Comics was headquartered, or is headquartered, has been for decades and decades and decades. So you've had some other offshoots, like the West Coast Avengers, or some groups in the UK, because they started a whole separate imprint for the UK at one point, I believe in the 70s, and had some special characters that basically only showed up to UK readers. But Black Panther has always been African, and he brings with him, in many of the storylines, a completely different perspective, because he's not coming from like an America first, American agenda point of view. He's not afraid of going toe-to-toe with the other heroes on things that he believes are morally questionable, or just out of line with the greater good beyond America, like the greater good for the world. He's also not opposed to making some very morally questionable decisions himself, for that same greater good. He doesn't hold himself so highly that he can't do anything that anyone would criticize or speak against him. He's not afraid of public opinion one way or the other, where some of the other heroes are, and they don't want to have any fall from grace in the media or in the public eye, or, you know, what have you. He kind of is above it, but humble enough to not brag and boast about it. He's just sort of very pragmatic about how he makes choices. You know what? If nobody else is going to do this, then it's my duty as king and hero to make it happen, because I can see clearly what the rest of them can't. This is the way it's got to be. And if all the weight of the decision falls on me, then so be it. That's part of my role. It's part of what I was born into and what I signed up for. So I like him. I think that he's got a very fresh perspective and flavor as a character, because he has a very different background. And the other thing that's beneficial is, as I mentioned, the nation that he is king over, Wakanda, is a fictional place on the African mainland, the continent, and it's the source of, in the comics, adamantium, and vibranium. In the cinematic universe, you've got to separate the two. The vibranium is Captain America's shield, and the adamantium, up to this point, has been with Fox and Wolverine. We'll see what the Disney deal does for bringing all that together some later point. But so vibranium in MCU terminology is from Wakanda, and they're the only nation that can process and utilize it. There's a lot of talk right now about how that's going to be shown in the movie and all the different things they can do with it, how versatile it is as a material. It's extraterrestrial in nature. So it doesn't follow the same principles of physics as any natural material that we know of in the real world. It gets a little bit of leeway, if you will.
As stated by the obvious statement by Spider-Man saying, that thing doesn't isn't defined by the laws of physics, is it?
Exactly.
In Civil War.
The beautiful thing about the other beautiful thing about the Black Panther story is that unlike most of the other characters who do have to rely on their memory of the past or things they've been told about, you know, ancestors or people who've gone before, part of his role as Black Panther enables him to commune with the spirits of his dead ancestors, specifically the previous Black Panthers in all of the generations before him, stretching back into antiquity. And he has an active present interaction with their spirits. He's not recalling things from storybooks, and he's not recalling things from like lessons he was taught in school or by his father, you know, when he was a prince. He's actually talking to their spirits with their personalities, their opinions. They are still active participants to a certain degree in the governance of Wakanda and whether or not they support his decisions as king. And that's an interesting new dynamic. I hope they're going to explore that in the film. We haven't seen a whole lot of the spirit realm yet in the trailers. You see a little bit, you know, with the purple tinged, you know, sky and all of that. That's most likely connected to the necropolis and that kind of dream state, wandering, you know, astral plane sort of stuff, like we've seen a little bit in Doctor Strange. But yeah, it's a very unique dynamic that you don't see anywhere else. And I think that it adds yet another layer of potency to him as a character and his storyline in the overall flow of, you know, this mega franchise cinematic universe.
I have a question for you guys. And this is a very poignant question, a very honest question, but it's a question that nevertheless has been speculated and asked and debated actually on social media, on the internet, in circles around with critics. And some people agree, some people are off put by the question, but would you categorize this film, Black Panther, as a black film? And I ask this because of the fact that I'll go ahead and step in and answer first. I feel like, to what Spencer was talking about earlier, I feel like this is definitely a black film in terms of the character's origin, the character's surroundings, his upbringing, what the entire culture that's being, you know, promoted and being celebrated. I mean, because aside from just obviously, like you said, it is a non-existent city, but within that city and in the comics, it celebrates a lot of traditions that are familiar to the African culture. And I'm hoping that even in the film too, as well, like, as you see a lot of traditional garb, you see a lot of individuals who are.
Yeah, I actually was reading an article a week or two ago, and it was fantastic, phenomenal. I think it was on IMDb from a set visit that a bunch of the, you know, more prominent press, people that are cooler than us, got to actually
one day, gentlemen, one day,
and see behind the scenes and talk to some of the performers and Ryan Coogler and the costume designer, the set design, the production, all that kind of stuff. And one of the things that is really brilliant about, yes, is Wakanda a nation that is made up for the fictional story universe? Yeah, absolutely. However, the brilliant leeway that you get with that is having a place that reflects many other places. One of the things that the costume designer in particular said in whatever this article was that I was reading was that she looked at different traditional, because it's not... It's a mistake for people from an American mindset or any other, you know, non with it, just not being familiar with Africa, to say, oh, Africa holistically is one culture. There are hundreds, if not thousands, of cultures present. It is a massive continent. And those cultures are among the very oldest in the history of like the human record of civilization. So to kind of artificially group everything into one lump sum bundle is a disservice to the diversity that's there. I mean, just everything, every language, cuisine, attire, sports and recreation, you name it. You know, there's a lot of beautiful diversity. And so what they did a lot on the production development side with the costumes and the sets and everything was they tried to take touch points and influences from various different cultures and kind of blend them into the futuristic tech, you know, Wakanda identity as well, so that Wakanda becomes, for a mainstream global audience, which is what we all are, becomes the start of a conversation of all of the diversity, right, that is present within Africa. Not like, oh, it's diversity because it's Africa that's different than the rest of the world. No, no, no. Diversity within Africa. From other places in Africa. And other cultures in Africa. You don't have to look anywhere else to find diversity. Same as any, you know, country, really, but especially the larger ones. I mean, look at China. And yes, there's a homogenized sense of the culture in China, but there are hundreds of subgroups with like cultural distinctions and language variations and everything that go back millennia. You know, to look at any large landmass and say, oh, that's all one thing is short-sighted of us. And I think one of the things that's going to be really great about this film, Black Panther, is that they were very aware, they were very cognizant and deliberate about deliberate about reflecting a multifaceted kind of melting pot culture that could potentially start a broader conversation, you know, on the global stage. I think that that was a smart move. I think that they should be applauded for putting that much thought and that much heart into just the look and feel of it, let alone what the storyline does.
What about you, Spence?
Well, you covered pretty much everything right there. That was awesome.
I'll be quiet now. Sorry. Once we get past the comic book movie part of this episode, I'll be a lot more tame. Maybe.
Yeah, going back to your question of is this a black film, I'd say yeah. It's a black film, but it's not just for black people. It's for
everyone. Oh, yeah, of course.
Yeah. Because as Chad was talking about like how... you know, you're taking like a little bit from everywhere and like melting it together. They also did that with the soundtrack, because I was actually reading about this earlier this week about how Kendrick Lamar is doing like a few songs for it. But the actual person who's doing it, whose name I'm going to butcher, it's Ludwig Göransson, actually went over to South Africa and Senegal and did like... got some
like audio samplings artists.
Yeah, he got some artists. Oh, wow. Some of the, like, you know, local magicians to do some of like the bass, like stuff. So there's actually going to be some of that sound in the soundtrack with it, which I think is really cool.
Yeah, that is super cool.
Awesome. Well, with that, we're going to jump.
Just so that I weigh in, I never answered your question. Yes, it's a black film, I think, but agreeing with you, Spencer, it's made for a global audience.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, no doubt. And I think that's one of the things that a lot of people... It's for another larger conversation, but people are being off-put by that. And I think it's ridiculous, because I think this particular type of film celebrates it while it is still open for a wide audience. Because, I mean, honestly, I'm going to enjoy the heck out of it, because it looks incredible, it sounds incredible, and from what everybody keeps saying and keeps, you know, teasing at, it is incredible. And I have no doubt of any of those things. And obviously, you and I, we are not black. We're not African-American. So
we are not.
But it does, I do want to highlight the fact that I think this film does such an incredible job, just from the visuals and from the music, from what I'm hearing, in celebrating that and celebrating that culture and having the opportunity to put it on without having, you know, some type of gimmick or some type of, you know, in that aspect. So that's kind of where my mind is.
I mean, quite frankly, there's a lot of potential in this movie.
Oh,
I mean,
yeah.
We've got an entire Infinity Stone that's missing that's likely to be in this film, right? But then also... It's so different than any of the other superhero films from any studio. Mm-hmm. It's so different. It has such a broader potential for appeal because of both the obvious and the subversive elements of the storyline that they could put in there. We haven't seen it yet, so we don't know. But a lot of early indications also are saying it's got one of the best bad guys and one of the most emotional story arcs of any of the recent superhero films.
Yeah.
But the bad guy, by the way, played by Michael B. Jordan, who was the star. I mean, he and Coogler have collaborated now on all three
both
of
films,
these,
yeah.
You know, mainstream films. So we're going to get into more about Michael B. Jordan in a moment, but you know, he was the star of Fruitvale Station and the star of Creed, as well. So obviously there's a rapport there that they were able to leverage, you know, and it sounds like to a very positive effect.
True. And speaking of previous films, this is the part where we jump right into Coogler's previous films. As we said, we're going to kind of touch on Fruitvale Station, which came out in 2013, as well as his sophomore film Creed, which debuted in 2015. But for those who don't know, Fruitvale Station is a story of Oscar Grant III, a 22-year-old Bay Area resident who crosses paths with families, enemies, family, and strangers on the last day of 2008. All that is based on a real-life story that sadly took place not too far from here in Oakland. And it was a really, I'm just going to be honest with our listeners, it was a really hard film to watch. It was a very real film because of just not only where we are, and like I said, we are in a racially charged world right now. So not that it hasn't been, and I know I have certain friends who listen to this who that'll be the first thing they'll come back on me and say, wait, what do you mean just now? It's always no, it has
yeah, this
always
didn't just start, Eddie.
it didn't just start. It has always we have always lived in a racially charged world, but it seems like because of the ability of social media and technology and the keen eye of certain individuals to document and to record and to catch the happenings that are just so wrong that are done in this day and age, it seems a little bit more prevalent in our society. And that's the nature of Fruitvale Station as you see the film. Like I said, we're not going to go throughout and go piece by piece, but the film is kicked off with a small handheld film recording of the events of the...
Yeah, it's the actual event. I mean, that's I think the point you're getting at is there are a large number of American citizens who have been truthfully telling stories about the injustice that they have faced in their lives for decades that have gone unbelieved. And now, because of technology, there's an abundance of evidence.
Yeah.
It's actual hard evidence that you cannot argue with. And this film starts out with actual smartphone camera or camera phone. I don't know. I think it was a smartphone.
It was some type of handheld
footage of the real life event, not the performers from the film reenacting the event. The first, 3 minutes of this film are the actual altercation in the BART station in Oakland. And that is a very sobering way to start.
Yeah.
Not that people hadn't already seen it in news coverage a few years prior.
Circulated.
Not that people weren't aware.
Yeah.
But like to start the film with the actual incident, essentially uninterrupted.
Yeah.
It sets a tone right from the beginning before you ever see
exactly
Michael B. Jordan in the role. Mm-hmm. It's the actual man and his friends.
And I think that's one of the unique things that Ryan Coogler does with this particular film, especially with his debut film right out from the get-go, reminding the people who are watching at the very beginning that you are, although this is a dramatization of, you know, an event, here is the actual event that had occurred that night or that morning, I guess, if you want to be technical, all the way up until the very shot of the gun, you know, obviously they're tasteful and they don't show anything past that in the footage. But it's a very unique choice in cutting a film in saying, okay, we're already doing a very gut-wrenching, very, very, very emotional film. But before we get into it, let's remind them of the reality of the world that they live in by showing them the actual. Because I think sometimes we find comfort in watching a movie about an event. I mean, just speaking from my personal experience, I sometimes feel like I'm a little bit more comfortable when I watch a film about real life events when I'm not too familiar with the events that happened and I may not have seen it on the news or anything of that sort. And in doing so, I can digest it a little bit better. But like with this one, right from the get-go, I'm like, it's like a shot to the gut and it's like, oh my goodness, this is going to really take you for a ride. I know one of the things that happened immediately, Spencer, and I say this because it's I'm kind of observant when it comes to watching other people enjoying films, because as much as I love to see the film, I also love seeing people, you know, digest the film and just, you know, intake it. And one of the first things you did was you decided to verify and check how closely is this film going to be to the actual story. But you have a little bit of a hesitancy when it comes to films certain like this.
Yeah, gosh, films like this are hard because, you know, they're based on people's real lives. Like, he actually got shot and he actually died, and it's hard to like just sit there and watch and not feel a little helpless. So, I don't know, as like a personal thing, I like to like at least see like, you know, oh, what parts of this movie actually happened? How much of this is artistic like liberties in certain areas? Because I don't want to feel bad about things that didn't actually happen. But yeah.
Which is interesting because usually when you have, you know, based on true events or whatever, you've got like an opening text scroll or just like text on the screen that kind of sets the scene, and then you drop into the dramatized version of the story. Very rarely do you have documentary style, like just cold start, just drop you straight into like, this is the climax of the story. And you're seeing it first, and then we hit the drama, you know, the dramatization component. With the, you know, the camera angles a certain way and the lighting and whatever and the performers. And I think many times before I've referenced the way that when you start a story, you make certain promises. And it's not necessarily like I'm making a great promise that you're going to enjoy this story. It's I'm making a promise to you. In this case, I'm making a promise that this is going to be as realistic and authentic as I can make it, as my team can make it.
Yeah.
We're starting with the real thing because we didn't add a lot of glitz and glamour and extra bells and whistles and change. And I think that that does honestly show in the film. I mean, it's not a very long film.
No.
But it feels kind of long because it doesn't chew through story the way that most modern films do. It really kind of takes its time to breathe in almost the mundaneness of certain components of a person's life. His in particular, obviously, in the case of this movie. But not every... Most movies, it's like if there's not some form of drama, conflict, you know, something going on in a scene, the scene gets cut. It never gets filmed or it gets left on the editing room floor. Here you've got several scenes where he's driving in his car. There's not really much happening. He's talking to his mom about her birthday. You have a little bit of a flashback to some time he spent in prison. But like it doesn't, it kind of lingers in a lot of quieter moments because... The feeling, the vibe that I got from it was that Coogler and his team didn't want to add too much extravagance and make it something that it wasn't.
Right. Well, like, another thing, a reason why I think that he, like, opened with that opening footage is that, like, along with setting, like, the tone for the rest of the movie of being, like, super real, is that it's also, I think, there to, like, put it in your head, like, this is how his day ends, and, like, you're just going with him through a whole day, and it's like, did he really deserve this? Does anyone really deserve this kind of treatment type thinking? That's what I took away from it.
And that goes to kind of what Chad was mentioning. That goes to, like, the pacing of the film and how the flow of the story goes, because there are times where the story is moving, but the only reason why it's moving is because the literal character is driving from point A to point B.
Sure.
And you're right. It does take its time in certain parts in terms of, like, standing at the register or the meat counter at the grocery store and kind of just talking with his friend and whatnot and helping somebody. But it's interesting how Coogler decides or chooses to do that, because I think it was very much intentional in my mind to establish the fact that he was just a regular person, a individual who this was almost a, you know, day in the life of kind of situation where, you know, you have where somebody has a documentarist who's watching him the entire day with a camera or something, you know, oh, this is what I do every day. This is how I live, you know. But although the film was only an hour and 20, hour and 30 long, those little bits did take a little bit to kind of process through and relay the whole message. I thought you could still do it probably in less time.
I think we're used to seeing stories move faster.
True. Like, very true.
Most mainstream films. I know there are some art house films that kind of meander and take their time, you know, to get through their paces, whatever those paces are. But I think we're just so conditioned now to, like, okay, let's move it along. Like, especially when you know how it ends, like, you're already dreading it. And I don't need to know anything that I don't need to know, right? Yeah. Like, just let's get through this and get it over with. I'm already unhappy, like, from the first frame. When you see, yeah, like, the first frame is, oh, this is the actual footage. I'm already done. I'm already toast because,
yeah.
But it's useful to force people to confront the reality of a situation. I think we've seen that time and time and time again in other stories that don't get made into movies, where you see cell phone footage of an altercation that should never have happened with, yeah, an ending that should not have been the way that it ended.
Yeah.
And there has to be a point at which, as a society, we say it's enough. Like, this cannot keep happening. We're killing each other for no reason.
Yeah.
And that comes across very strongly. He doesn't get portrayed as some paragon of virtue, an amazing, remarkable, heroic human being with the brightest possible future ahead of him. It's not that kind of story. He's a guy who's made mistakes, who's tried to fix some of those mistakes, and who's trying to find a way to provide for his family, and especially his daughter.
Yeah.
And that comes across very strongly without painting him as, you know, some guy on a pedestal that was, you know, he's not like a Martin Luther King Jr.
Yeah,
or
yeah,
a Robert Kennedy, you know, people who were assassinated for their beliefs and their prominence.
Mm-hmm.
He's, like you said, Eddie, he's, you know, just average everyday guy. You know, he's done bad things. He's done good things. He did not deserve the ending that he got.
And I think one of the key things about this particular film, one of the key takeaways, if you will, that I think Ryan Coogler wanted to really emphasize with people who went to go see this film, was the fact that it set out to do exactly what it set out to do, which was to stir up the conversation, begin the conversation. It wasn't so much as, I in my personal opinion, and I might be wrong, I don't think Ryan Coogler set out to create this film with the intent of, oh man, this is going to get so many Oscars and this is going to get, you know, so much or whatever. And, you know, and then, oh my gosh, we're going to get all these BAFTA awards and we're going to get all these, you know. I think truly in his heart, I think the focus of that particular, this particular film was, we need to start this conversation. We need to get this thing, get people talking about why this is not okay, why this is definitely an epidemic in our country today. And
for sure. And I think a lot of credit also goes to people behind the scenes. Forrest mm-hmm. Whitaker does not appear in this movie.
No.
But financed
mm-hmm.
quite a bit of it. Octavia Spencer does appear in the movie and decided to forego a salary in order to make sure that it got made.
Yeah.
And others. I mean, those are the names that I know because they're performers. I know it's not fair to the other financiers that, no. you know, made sure that this movie was seen all the way through to from production all the way through to distribution. You know, but it was an incredible effort behind the scenes to get this film made, finalized, and distributed.
Yeah. So 2 years after Fruitvale Station, Coogler ends up coming out with a really interesting film that honestly took me by surprise, because I'm like, wait, this is actually another Rocky film? And obviously we're talking about Creed. Back in 2015, the story of a young boxer who happens to be the illegitimate child of Apollo Creed, who was a world champion boxer during the time of the first few Rocky films, and grows up being a very angry child and decides to, under the training and tutelage of Rocky himself, Rocky Balboa, get into boxing and fights all the way to glory. So
very quickly too.
True.
I mean, it's definitely one of the, well, it's not really a rags to riches story. It's like,
definitely not.
It's an interesting thing. Cause he does start as a young boy. He's in the foster care system, or group home. Actually, he's in a group home. And then Apollo Creed's wife, mm-hmm. played by Felicia Rashad.
Amazing.
Yeah. I mean, come on. I wanted more of Mrs. Huxtable in this movie, because she's just phenomenal.
True.
But she essentially takes him out of the group home, takes him into her home. They have all of the, you know, the wealth from Apollo's winnings in the ring before his passing. And so he does have a rough beginning of life, and then he has a very privileged you know, later developmental cycle. And then he chooses to leave a lucrative job and follow in his father's footsteps and become a boxer.
True.
Against her wishes.
Yeah. And this is obviously, this isn't a similar film to Fruitvale Station. This is actually quite the opposite. This is not based on a true story. Rocky is not real. Although Sylvester Stallone is a real person.
Rocky is real in many people's hearts, because I mean, aside from James Bond,
true.
I mean, what character has lasted this long through so many iterations?
Very true.
And especially with the same performer.
Oh, yeah.
Rocky himself has never changed.
It's true.
It's always been Sly Stallone.
Which, I mean, if you want to talk about rags to riches in terms of that, I mean, Sylvester Stallone wrote and directed the first film, shopped it around to everybody,
yep.
and nobody wanted to give him a chance. And yeah, it's a great story if you ever read about it. But this film is quite different in terms of like pacing and in terms of like the actual story development through this. You have incredible performances by obviously Michael B. Jordan, Felicia Rashad. You have a character that is played by Tessa Thompson, who happens to be Chad in the Marvel Universe.
Oh, Valkyrie. Sorry. I was like, Bianca is the character's name. I'm like... Who happens to be Bianca?
You I figured like, you would have been on that, like,
the like moody alt goth rock synth singer person, like.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, no, you're correct. She was Valkyrie in Thor Ragnarok, and we should definitely be seeing her again.
Very true, and of course, Sylvester Stallone himself reprising his titular role in all the previous films. This is a much different film. This film has a different drive. There are parts of the film that have this really fast pacing portion, usually in the large action sequences where he's fighting or he's doing stuff. And then it takes its time in the moments where it really wants you to chew on exactly what's happening in the scene. And I think it wasn't until we saw Creed that made me truly realize that Ryan Coogler has a very keen eye for very specific details. Mm-hmm. And it was a point, you know, even when we were watching some of the scenes and she slyly puts in something in her ear and they're walking out, and I was like, wait, she put something in her ear. And then, like, not even 5-10 minutes into that scene, you know, he's like, so how long have you been, you know, and that becomes a whole incredible scene between Michael B. Jordan and Tessa Thompson. So it just told me that, you know, Ryan Coogler is very specific with his eye, and he's very particular, but he knows how to pace a film.
Yeah, I mean, there are definitely several sequences. There's something to be said for having strong funding,
mm-hmm.
right?
There was very true.
Definitely more money for Creed than there was for Fruitvale Station. Most likely a larger crew, longer shoot time, and more assurances on distribution. So somebody like, you know, Rocky Balboa can kind of secure that. Since it's a franchise character with a significant cachet, as they say. And that definitely comes across. However, one of the things that really delighted me about the movie wasn't so much all of the fanciness, because there is a lot of fanciness. There are multiple camera sequences where the camera is circulating around Michael B. Jordan as the performer, as he's fighting or walking or training or whatever, and everything around, it's all synchronized, it's all working.
Mm-hmm.
It's very unique and distinctive and cool to see, especially that they did it more than once. It wasn't just like a one-time trick. They do it 7 or 8 times at least in this film. But beyond all of the interesting visual components of the movie, I was really impressed with the heart. I was really impressed with the character moments all throughout the story. It is not a story about a guy who wants to become a boxer to prove to his deceased father that he never met that he was worth knowing the whole time. That's a component of it, but it's also the development of this sort of father-son bond between Adonis, who is Adonis Johnson, who is Apollo Creed's son, Michael B. Jordan's character, and Rocky. It's also about the sort of collision / blending of two broken people, sort of interacting and then falling away from each other and then interacting again, you know, between Adonis and Bianca, Tessa Thompson's character.
Yeah.
And it's treated in a very realistic, humane kind of way. Mm-hmm. Like, it's not perfect, but it's also not devastatingly dramatic and terrible.
Yeah.
There's a really nice balance of it feels like you're watching real people interact. And that not everybody can pull that off.
One of the things I liked about this movie was the makeup that they had. Because, like, there's part of the movie where, like, Sylvester needs to look, like, even older than he does because he's going through some stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, when I saw him, I'm like, oh, Rocky got old. Like, real old.
Really old. Yeah.
I was like, oh, no.
And that's another component of the story that you are presented with, along with everything else that Chad was talking about. You're also given the rare glimpse of seeing the mortality of the famed Italian stallion that has been...
He doesn't die in the movie.
It's not
mortality in that sense.
But no.
He is mortal.
Yes, yeah. Because you've seen him, like, in every other fight and everything throughout all the other films as this guy who's been tough as nails. And you know, he's, you know, I joke every time we see the film because, you know, there's a famous line that Mickey says in the first Rocky. He says, "You're going to eat lightning and crap thunder." So it's really...
It's a very Eddie quote.
It is.
A very Eddie quote.
Oh, that's going to kill me. But, he's a very resilient character in all the films. And resiliency, I think, is the prominent through line through all the films. And then you get to this film, and he begins to face something medically that just begins to put him on his knees and just really beats into him. And it's really difficult to see the character you have grown up with, who has defeated everything from, you know, the world heavyweight champion to, you know, the Siberian death train from, you know, communist Russia, and you have,
well, not to mention the brain damage, the passing of his wife, the like other things that happen to human beings. That's one of the things that makes Rocky so watchable, is that it's not just the sport spectacle, although that is really well done in almost all of them and totally watchable, but it's the human side of it too.
So I just to speak on that, like even talking about those things, you know, with the passing of his wife, and in this film, if you haven't seen it, you need to get out there and see it. We're going to talk about it anyway. But like also with the passing of his brother-in-law and him ultimately facing that mortality, saying, you know what, I'm ready to go. If this takes me, I'm just, you know, it's whatever, you know, I'm good to go. And that, you know, kind of struck me. I'm like you said, Chad, it's a really great glimpse inside, you know, the everyman of our day, you know. Were you going to say something, Spence?
I was, but you kind of went in there, so I'm like, I don't need to.
No, go for it.
I was just going to say that too. Yeah, like once he finally was talking about, I'm good. And I'm like, you're what? You're good? You're Rocky Balboa. You punch things in the face. You get punched in the face, you get knocked down, and then you train in a barn in Siberia, and then you come back stronger than ever. So I was like blown away. And then he was talking about, like, you know, Adrian was gone and all this stuff. And I'm like, dang. Like it really just got me. It was great.
It was. It was. And it's really crazy how much he is such one of those unknown heroes that, like, obviously a lot of people know of him, but they don't really know the full story of, like, Rocky and how all the films transpire. So he's one of, like, those unsung heroes to me, like, in terms of cinema, that has constantly been, like, a force for, like, good and progression and, like, and resiliency. And mind you, you have some people who
You're talking about Rocky.
I'm talking about Rocky.
Okay.
No, who?
Well, I was just. I lost. Sorry. More train of thought for a second.
But no. So
it was when you said not everybody knows who he is. When it's like pretty much everybody is at least somewhat familiar. Well, with him.
They know. Yeah, exactly. They know of him, but like
they certainly know his theme song.
True. Do do do. Yeah, all that stuff.
Yeah.
And it's really great. It's funny that you mentioned the camera usage, because I've only seen takes like this in like certain indie films and whatnot. Like Alfonso Cuarón is known for that with his film Birdman that he did, where he does a lot of those one takes where he's following.
Yeah, Birdman is its own. That's a whole different. That's a masterclass in that kind of like flipping point of view without cutting the scene.
Well, I mean, some of these ones, like
filmmaking
in this particular film, the opening scene is. Just as, in my opinion, I think it's just as good as like the whole scene where in Birdman, where Michael Keaton gets locked down, he has to walk all the way around, you know, Times Square just to get back into the theater for his own show. I thought this was a really good shot where you have him from the locker room and you follow him all the way up through this, you know, maze of stairs and whatnot up to this place where he gets into the ring, and then the cameraman gets into the ring, and there's no stopping on. In that fight, it's just all one continuous shot, or at least it looks like it.
It certainly does feel that way, yeah. And in several of the sequences, mostly the fighting sequences, but it's not always just the fighting sequences where that happens. It was really compelling to watch. It definitely was the kind of film where Fruitvale Station, I mean, again, this is, we're talking specifically about Ryan Coogler and his role as director and writer on both projects.
Yes.
And the way that he decides to tell a story, I think that in both cases has a lot of heart. But I think where Fruitvale Station, I really noticed the passage of time because there wasn't a lot of activity happening. In my opinion, again, used to the type of pacing that we typically see in mainstream films. But in Creed, there was a lot happening, even in quiet moments. It was totally a step up. From the style of storytelling that we had seen in the other film. I was really, really impressed with what I took to be an indication of his growth as a filmmaker. And really, I think from Fruitvale Station through to Creed, I mean, he definitely, I would say Creed fully establishes him as a person to watch and even follow as a filmmaker, regardless of what role he decides to take behind the camera.
Well, okay, you're not alone in feeling like Fruitvale Station was a bit of a slow march through that, because I was right there with you, because it was just like waiting for that whole moment to happen. And yeah, in Creed, definitely, like, things were definitely a step up from, like, just like his own film style, because, like, there was just so much happening, but it was all followable at the same time.
Yes.
So it was like amazing. I was like, this is so good, which is one of the reasons why I'm so excited about Black Panther, because I know all that stuff is just gonna come right into it.
Yeah.
So that's gonna be really great.
And it's really interesting that you say in terms of the runtime, because this, we happened to find out that night we saw the film that this happens to be the longest running timed Rocky film in the entire franchise.
Yes.
Which is funny, because as you mentioned, it does not feel like a 2-hour and 20-odd minute film. But it is true, the way Ryan Coogler is able to follow each individual character, and not only just follow and give, you know, be able to keep up with them in terms of their blocking of the scene, but to also give importance on the minuscule aspects of the character, whether if it's a character who is, you know, taking groceries out of a van and giving them to somebody, and then somebody steps in and takes over and starts doing it, and that being a slight comedic bit. Or you have, like I was talking about earlier, the small instance where somebody puts something in their ear real quickly and then it becomes a point of conversation after the fact. You can tell that Ryan Coogler, although he knows how to really keep the pacing quite well in each scene, he still knows how to make sure that you as an audience member are aware of all the things
in
the scene.
And you know, the
exactly, yeah.
The ear thing is a perfect example, because I mean, I remember you watch her put it on, but it's not, you're not close up on her ear. You need to be paying attention to the fact that it's there. Because
mm-hmm.
we all looked at each other. I was like, is she deaf?
Yeah.
And you said, wait a minute, does she have something behind her ear? And then, you know, it wasn't 5 minutes later. It was about a minute and a half later that they're sitting down at dinner, and Adonis asks her about that, and she explains mm-hmm. what's going on with her. But you, as the audience member, you already knew it was telegraphed, but not in a ridiculous way. It invites you to pay attention. And I think that can be a rare thing. Usually filmmakers either, you know, kind of slide it in after the fact and you're like, wait a minute, why, how did you set that up? You didn't set that up. You didn't do that right.
Mm.
Or they beat you over the head with it. Because they don't want you to be confused. And I think he gets into that sweet spot right in the middle, where there are certain things that are never said by the characters, but the overall tone and pacing and, you know, shot composition and whatever of the scene tells you everything that you need to know.
Yeah.
And I like that it's not a perfect film. The storyline isn't perfect. The characters certainly are not perfect.
No.
You know, similar, you know, in a way to Fruitvale Station. It's not about perfect people doing exactly the right thing. Mm-mm. It's about realistic people doing realistic things.
Yeah.
And hopefully coming out on top, unlike in Fruitvale Station, which just totally, I mean, dropped you.
Yeah.
You knew it was going to. But you still kind of were wishing that it did. I don't know. I'm an optimist. I was like, I wish it would, I don't know, like, tell me something that happened 5 years later that was at least somewhat, you know, nice.
Yeah, I was like waiting for that, and then the movie just ended.
Yeah,
and I
was
like,
just like,
done.
And speaking to that as well, I think one of the unique graduated differences between Fruitvale and Creed, which honestly you can't do much in terms of Fruitvale in terms of the liberties, because you usually go by what was said or by secondhand observation.
Yeah, you'd almost be making a mockery of it if you changed too many things.
Exactly, right? But in terms of like the script, even we've talked off air that, you know, the script in Fruitvale was very to the point. It was very much like if the conversations obviously happened in real life, which mm-hmm. they did, and so they kept to that. And you know, but in Creed, there was a lot of great dialogue, a lot of great conversations that happened. And I think for me, that's one of the key things that have always that has always kept me engaged in a lot of the Rocky films. Although it's a fighting film, of course, you still have great interactions, whether if it's between Rocky and Adrian, it's between Rocky and Apollo, whether if it's between Rocky and Polly. You know, there's always a moment in the film that really solidifies the heart of what you're expecting in this particular project. Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of the things that Ryan Coogler really shows and shines in this film, that I honestly would not have guessed until after the fact I looked it up that Sylvester Stallone himself didn't have a hand in writing this film, because it feels like it belongs in the rest of the
very much
franchise.
So, yeah. Very so, much so.
But I think that's one of the things in terms of, so kind of rounding
now
he is
writing the follow-up. Sylvester Stallone is doing the script for Creed 2.
I didn't know that.
Well, it's tentatively called Creed 2, but you know, but yeah, it gets a follow-up. No, I mean, unlike Fruitvale Station, the characters survive, which is good.
Yes.
And you know, so they will continue. And the film was very well received. This put Tessa Thompson on the map in a major way. And she'll be back for the next one. Michael B. Jordan will be back. Sylvester Stallone will be back. We'll see what state his health is in.
True.
Right.
Because that's somewhat unresolved. It's pretty unresolved by the end of this film, but
yeah.
But he's still alive. That's good.
It's very good. But bringing this back around full circle, back to Black Panther, knowing what we've seen with Ryan Coogler and seeing a lot of his points of expertise when it comes to filmmaking, the things that he's worked on and he's continued to progress in and things like that. What are some of the things that you guys are expecting to see out of Black Panther that you know Ryan Coogler is capable of delivering?
I'm hoping for amazing fight sequences after seeing Creed.
Yes.
Oh, true.
Yes.
Because he needs to bring the heat on that, really.
Yeah, if there's one thing that you've recognized with Michael B. Jordan is that it looks like the man puts in the work for like training for the films that he's doing.
Oh, yeah.
Like,
for sure.
He was doing all of those things, you know, in the gym and all that. He was doing all that. I'm pretty sure they didn't have stunt doubles in every scene of them, but like in some of them where he was doing the jump ropes and the push-ups and the speed bags and everything, it's like, man, this guy knows his stuff. So I agree with you 100%. That is one of the things that I'm really hoping to see, because it looks like he has a really good eye for not just having them choreographed well, but having them filmed well.
Yeah.
Because that's also another key thing that came out of Creed.
I would say one thing that I'm really looking forward to is having some strong women characters. They're definitely present in his other films, but like there are some characters in Black Panther that are like the definition of a strong woman character. Like that is their story function.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, you know, we've already seen some glimpses in the preview footage.
Yeah.
And I'm really excited to see him embrace that component of the story. He's got some phenomenal female performers, very strong stage presence, you know, very like good physicality, and the characters are like second to none.
Yeah.
So I'm really excited to see that come to the forefront a little bit more. You know, with Black Panther.
I think as for myself, obviously him taking the events of Fruitvale Station, there wasn't much to take liberties with. And obviously with all respect, you know, he couldn't. But when it came to Creed, him being able to create within the same universe that this film has been a part of since the 70s and still maintain that same heartbeat and that same feeling and vibe as what the other films had done. One of the things I'm looking forward to is seeing Ryan Coogler create an incredible, heartfelt film that doesn't take away from the action, but still delivers on what it means to be a superhero, as well as being a king, as well as, you know, being in the midst of something like some large evil, you know, looming over. I want to see all those aspects of, you know, T'Challa, and I want to see all those aspects of what it means to him. And I know Ryan Coogler is definitely capable of exploring that aspect of our character and seeing how deep does his, you know, I guess, his heart well go. So,
I mean, T'Challa, and who, that's the given name of Black Panther.
Sorry,
right?
You're right.
He's one of the absolute best characters in comic books. So you should absolutely feel that way about him, seeing him in his own movie on the screen.
Yeah. Well, that about wraps up another awesome episode of The Film Philosophers. Again, if you agree with us on Ryan Coogler, or if you have your own personal opinion and you want to share it with us, drop us a line on our Facebook page at facebook.com/filmphilosophers or on our Twitter page at twitter.com/philosophy101. This was a great conversation. And before we go, we're going to leave you with a couple of upcoming weekend releases. To let you know, we got the 1517 to Paris debuts this weekend, 50 Shades Freed. Spencer, that's all for you this weekend. And Peter Rabbit debuting this weekend. So
that one's all for you.
Thank you. I'll take it. It looks like it's going to be an exciting weekend for films and whatnot. So if you get a chance, go out there, see some of the stuff. And if anything, continue to be excited for this film. This film looks to be a very unique and possibly prolific film in the Marvel Universe as what it has to offer and what it stands to represent.
Black Panther comes out next week, not this week.
Exactly. So
unless you get a screener pass.
Unless you get a screener, or unless you begin to do your research and begin to look at the characters through its comic book history, which I'm pretty sure I'll probably be doing. And
I'm sure you'll be doing that too.
This was an awesome conversation. Again, thank you guys for being a part of it. And I'm stoked for Black Panther. That's all I can say.
Me too.
So from all of us
you
here,
looked at me so expectantly. I was like, okay, yeah.
No,
I am also. I think we've covered it, Spencer.
I'm very excited.
Are you sure? Are you sure?
I'm so excited. I just can't hide it.
And on that note, from all of us here,
I smell a meme coming.
From all of us here at the Film Philosophers, I'm Eddie.
I'm Chad.
I'm Spence.
Class dismissed.